What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning on Too Jewish are Amy Israel Pregelman and John Pregelman, the founders of Kavod, the organization that works ensuring dignity to Holocaust survivors. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shinshinim, Chaim Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's August now, which means Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the Jewish High Holy Days, are now just 5 weeks away. Over the course of the next few weeks here on Too Jewish, we'll explore these coming days of awe, but this morning I want to address a different matter, a problem, really, that's been bothering me a lot over the last few months. It's the question of what constitutes truth. The issue is an important one, perhaps never more so than at a time when so much of the public discourse in this world seems to be focused on contrary views of basic facts. I cannot recall a time when the most fundamental aspects of public life, the common agreement on what is and isn't real, have been more subject to intense disagreement. Here in America, we can't seem to agree any more on what seemed like obvious facts. How many people are present in a crowd, what the word no means, whether the world is getting hotter or not, where someone was born, or if our own intelligence services are telling us the truth about our enemies. There are always legitimate differences of opinion in a free society about events and policies, and these are naturally subject to interpretation. But what we have increasingly seen in recent years is the deliberate dissemination of falsehoods and the intentional wide spreading of misinformation. The ensuing controversies are not about the right way to do things, but about what is actually going on in the first place. And that weird ambiguity, the strange and disturbing sense that what used to be facts are now considered opinions, that what clearly appears to be happening is not generally accepted as real, this is doing great damage. I'm not saying America was an infinitely better place when we all believed everything Walter Cronkite said on the CBS Evening News. We did believe it, by the way. Or that challenging accepted pieties is a bad thing. But I am saying that something very, very weird has taken place over the past couple of decades that has called into question so many simple facts that we are now very often unable to tell truth from lie. As Shakespeare has Falstaff exclaim in King Henry IV, Part 1, "Is not the truth the truth?" Lest you think this is all the result of some deliberate effort on one political side, I must tell you that much of this confusion began with an academic assault on the verities of accepted scholarship. It was a philosophical attack from the left, initially, that stated that truth was relative. You believe about the world what you believe, while I believe what I believe about the world, and who's to say who's right or what's actually true? In this way of thinking, not only is beauty in the eye of the beholder, but so is truth. There are many truths in the world, and they can conflict freely, because truth, according to this, is actually just a matter of opinion. This approach is called relativism, and it's often associated with postmodernism and philosophers like Michel Foucault and Richard Rorty. It's a quite contemporary school of thought, actually, and it calls into question the very nature of truth. I have many times heard people argue, on the left side of the political spectrum most of the time, "Well, that is your truth, but I have my own truth, and there is no such thing as objective truth." That approach, facts are just a matter of opinion, or if you will, the medium is the message, was in the past the province of con men, shysters, and quacks. and later of professional political liars like Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propagandist who invented and popularized the use of the big lie. In later years, it moved into the realm of postmodern philosophers and sometimes groovy, soft-thinking leftists with far less malign intentions but damaging applications nonetheless. Well, this has now been adopted wholesale by the leaders of entire nations, including those who pretend to represent conservative values based on eternal verities and unshakable truths. And because of this, it has become nearly impossible to find agreement in society on the most basic facts. Truth has indeed ceased to be truth. I'm not just talking about politicians. You know the old joke, how can you tell when a politician is lying? His lips are moving. But back in the day when that joke was funny, we were talking about the promises politicians made that were never kept. Read my lips, no new taxes, or I will keep our boys out of war. Promises that weren't worth the paper they weren't written on. But today, it's not the promises we can't trust, it's everything. Virtually every single statement made by some leaders, well, it's not true. And it's the entire way our fragmented media reports things, well, these falsehoods suddenly become true to some people. Last week, Facebook, the humongous social media network created by Mark Zuckerberg, changed a variety of policies in an effort to combat what's widely viewed as disinformation, the deliberate spread of falsehoods in an effort to influence public opinion and even election results. No, not officially advertising, just opinion changing. We will see what effect these Facebook changes have. I hope they have some positive impact. Look, we do value freedom of speech. We just shouldn't value the freedom to deny facts and wildly invent lies. Without making this too political, I may have already done so, I want to talk about what Judaism understands the word truth, emet, to mean. Truth is associated almost universally in Judaism with God's essential nature. In fact, the Hebrew word emet, truth, is considered to be composed of three letters, Aleph, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Taf, the final one, and Mem, the middle one. Emet, it covers everything. God is truth. As Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel puts it in Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Ancestors, the world is sustained on three things, by justice, by truth, and by peace. The Talmud tells us that truth is the seal of God. And the Zohar teaches that there is no faith without truth. Truth in Judaism is profound, eternal, unchangeable. It isn't relative. It is not the result of some careful combination of bombast, advertising, and weak memories. Truth is not the result of persuasive opinions repeated endlessly and falsely. It is not based on aggressively propounded, invented stories pretending to be fact. It is not the denial of fact in the service of ulterior dishonest motives. Truth is not a lie that pretends to be true to one person or to some party's devious advantage and another's deliberate disadvantage. Truth is real, unmediated, and honest in Judaism. It is fact. It is hard, concrete, unshaken. And truth is, in essence, what God represents. Therefore, to actively promote falsehood is more than wrong. It is an abomination. And it damages everyone involved. As we approach a time of year when we do some serious soul-searching, let us strive to do so honestly. And let us insist that those who represent us and those who speak to the world about what is happening in the world do so in truth, based on facts. To play us in this morning, here's Alan Naplin's lovely setting of a passage from Pirkei Avot, by three things the world is sustained, by justice, by truth, and by peace. Al Shlosha Devarim. Oh, was Alan Naplan's lovely setting of Al Shlosha Devarim. The world is sustained by truth, justice, and peace. In a moment, we'll meet Amy Israel Pregelman and John Pregelman, the founders of Kavod, an organization that works to ensure dignity to Holocaust survivors everywhere in this country. Meet them and learn about their amazing work when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish, Amy Israel Pregelman and John Pregelman, the founders of Kavod, an organization that helps ensure dignity for Holocaust survivors and does incredible work in an area that many people didn't know was necessary. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. How are you?
Thanks for having us.
Well, delighted to have you guys. Tell us a little bit about the origin of Kavod and how you became aware of the need for such an organization.
Okay. Well, about 5 years ago, I started taking photos of survivors. A friend of mine from the Illinois Holocaust Museum asked me to come take photos. He needed a new exhibit. And I really became enthralled with these amazing, positive, and accomplished people. I picked photos of 80 of them in 3 days. And from that, I started taking photos all over the country of survivors. And many times I would go to their homes. And when I was in Orlando later that year, 2012, I think it was, I took photos of a 94-year-old female survivor. And as always happens, she wanted to give me something to eat afterwards.
Right.
And when we went to her refrigerator, there was really nothing there. There was some milk and cheese and a loaf of bread. And I said to her, you know, where is your food? What happened? And she said, I ran into an expense I didn't expect. I had to fix my air conditioner. And I had to use my food money for that. So I just didn't buy food this month.
Oh, my God.
So Amy and I were just shocked by this and did some research into this problem and discovered that 30 to 35% of the 100,000 survivors living in the U.S. are living at or close to poverty levels. So we decided that we had to do something, even if it was small. So we created Kavod, which means dignity. And the mission of Kavod is to provide confidential emergency aid to survivors in the United States living in poverty. So that we started in November of 2015. So that's how it all started.
That's in a nutshell.
That's a pretty good nutshell. You know, I think it would shock a lot of American Jews and others to realize that there are 100,000 survivors now, more than 70 years after the end of the Shoah. Just in the United States. I understand the condition of survivors in other countries after the United States is the wealthiest, certainly one of the wealthiest countries in the world. The condition of survivors in other countries is not nearly as good as it is here. And we can talk about that a little bit when we get back in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's
TOOJewishRadio18@gmail.com, or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcast top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Israel has had visits recently from Viktor Orban, the kind of autocratic head of Hungary. But the relationship, which has highlighted the fact that Israel doesn't just have sort of a relationship with the European Union or something, and it, of course, it's a very strong relationship with the United States, but it also has individual and important diplomatic relations with Eastern European countries. Mm-hmm. But some of these go way back, don't they?
Right. So first of all, you're right. There's a relationship with so many countries in Eastern Europe from 47 and before, and not now. You know, it's not that it started now. And it started first when we worked on bringing Jews from those countries after World War II to Israel, and we needed the help, you know, help of the officials there. That's number one.
And sometimes they were communist officials, and sometimes they were, you know,
And then we had to build an army. So that was another thing that we needed their help with, weaponry and things like that. This is all not top secret, you know.
No, not anymore. It's not a long anymore. 70 years ago.
Right.
Well, you know, I think people don't remember that the United States, certainly Britain, wasn't going to sell the Israelis any arms at that point. And so
not the French too.
And not the French either, right? None of the Allies were going to support Israel because it was a colony of Britain, right?
Right.
And so a lot of the Israeli arms came from Czechoslovakia in those days. That was the best of them. And they came from Hungary and they came from other now Eastern Bloc countries.
Right. So as we say, you know, everything is not that simple. So in life, sometimes you do things that are the right thing to do and sometimes you think that you need to do. So the relationship in any country in the world, including the United States, you know, we have relationships that we all know about and we have relationships that we don't know, but they're good for our interest. You know, that's the way it works. So we, you know, as we go older, we understand that there's, I will say, over the table and underneath the table. You do whatever you do, you know, to survive and, you know, to improve your country.
Well, and, you know, while there's been a lot of attention this summer on the American relationship with Russia, Israel's had an ongoing relationship with Russia.
Right. As we say, many, many years, right? And now there's a personal relationship between the president and the prime minister. I'm sure it's very complex with the Trump relationship as well.
Undoubtedly.
You know? And again, you know, it's too complicated to talk about that. But obviously, it's no secret that Benjamin Netanyahu visited Russia, you know, and has a good relationship with Putin.
So very interesting and important because Israel's strategic interests involve
Syria, Iran,
right?
Right. So what we're doing,
as well as a number of Israeli nationals who are from Russia, of course, or from the other Eastern Bloc countries. Used to be Eastern Bloc countries.
Of course. One point that you mentioned is that obviously Syria borders with Israel. There's Iranian presence. It was always there. There's Iranian presence in Syria.
Military
so
presence.
We're talking about weapons that come in and go to Lebanon, to Hezbollah, or go to Assad, you know, Bashar Assad. So we know that in order for us to put pressure on Syria and on Iran, we need Russia's help. You know,
fascinating.
That's the way it is.
Boy, the world is a complicated place.
It is, Rabbi. It is.
It is for everyone, but certainly for Israel. Thanks, Amir. We'll talk next week.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You've just returned from various parts of Europe, France, Greece, and Montenegro. So let's take it sequentially. Tell us about your experiences.
Okay. My trip was possibly less diverse than yours and certainly less focused on Jewish communities and Jewish events, but I will be happy to talk about it. So first I flew into the city of Toulouse, which is a major city in southwestern France. It was a Roman city. It is the place where Airbus has its major manufacturing plant. And so at the airport, you see the aircraft of all kinds of airlines from around the world that don't actually fly to Toulouse, but their airplanes are painted and delivered there, and then they're flown out of there to whatever, Dubai or wherever they're from. So Toulouse itself has an absolutely gorgeous cathedral that's one of the major pilgrimage points in the Middle Ages of Western Christianity, which, as you know, until the Reformation meant Roman Catholicism. It's a fabulous church. Toulouse has a very old Jewish community, which was rejuvenated by the arrival of French Jews who had lived in all the French colonies in North Africa,
right.
Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, right. And particularly after the Algerian War, a lot of French Jews didn't want to remove themselves too far from Mediterranean weather, climate, culture, whatever. So they stayed in the south of France, often in big cities like Marseille or Nice, but also Toulouse and Bordeaux. It was less of a culture shock for them to stay in the south than to move up to Paris. All right. So the reason I flew to Toulouse was that I have friends who live about an hour north in a farmhouse that they restored in the countryside just outside a smaller city called Cahors. And what's interesting about Cahors, which is Cahors, is that it is the original producer of Malbec in the world. The vineyards were planted by the Romans, and for a long time it was considered like a cheap, intoxicating wine. And the very first time that I was in France in the late 70s, you could buy a bottle of Cahors in a grocery store for under $1. It's a little bit better now. It's a little more refined and a little bit more expensive. And there's a much wider range of Malbec produced in and around Cahors than there is in and around Mendoza, Argentina, which is the other wine region known for its Malbec. They tend to make the same blends. They make a fabulous port out of Malbec. But Cahors itself is a beautiful town, which also has a very interesting looking old church. It's a 9th century church, or maybe a 10th century church, more accurately, that combines elements of Byzantine architecture and Gothic architecture. It's quite interesting. Yeah. It's got domes and cloisters, and it's sort of a hodgepodge of styles that grew with the city over a period of maybe 800 years. So it's a lovely place, a lovely corner of France. I saw friends, I saw Jews, and I saw lots of evidence of Romans.
Fascinating. I might add also that, although not everybody knows this, but there were lots of Jews who were wine merchants. A lot of the wine business was carried on in the Middle Ages by Jews.
Correct.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shinshinim, Chendon Hachi and Tamir Shakuri, for their final visit before they fly back to Israel. Oh, the trauma. And join the military and go on with their lives. Welcome, Boker Tov, and thank you for doing such a great job on behalf of the Weintraub Israel Center and on behalf of the nation of Medinat Yisrael this
Boker
year.
Boker Or.
So, just, you know, your thoughts on this last Too Jewish recording session here.
I don't think I can fully understand what this year was until after I get back to Israel and see my friends, my family, talk and then be like, oh, that happened. So I think I am different as a person. I think I realized a lot about myself. I learned a lot. I matured. I gained responsibility. I did things that I never did before, and I think it's great. I saw a lot of beautiful places, met thousands of people, literally. And I think it's really cool that in this year we just got to experience so many different things. Also working in like this program like a married couple, like a lot of people would tell us, but very differently, because we would not be at home together. We would just work together and that's it.
We also did not choose each other.
Yeah. It's been like, it's like a shidduch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
you were fixed up by a shadchan or a shadchanit from the Israel Center. That's correct.
Turned out fine, just saying. Turned out great.
I think it turned out great.
Very fine. Very, very fine.
All right, I think we better hear from Chen now, Tamir, before it gets any stronger here, but before you get yourself into any more trouble.
Yeah, but my main point is that I think we did bring everything we wanted to bring in terms of Israel, in terms of what we had to say about what it's like to be an Israeli culture, food, games, mentality. And I believe that whatever we did right now will just continue to grow as much as other Shinshini will come, other Shlichim. And it's just a never-ending process because people come and go and people change their opinions and they always need someone to talk to. And I think it's just a great opportunity.
And I think you guys have put a great face of Israel.
It's for fine.
Not only young people, but lots of others. Chen, your thoughts, because you always have thoughts.
I think that this year has been undescribable, if that's not a word, it now is.
Indescribable.
I don't think I can fully comprehend it, as Tamir already said. It's crazy to try to sum it up. There's obviously been a lot of good, and it's also a very intense year. It definitely, you don't mature unless you have difficulties, and you don't grow from just having fun all year. But we definitely had a lot of opportunities to grow, and we definitely had a lot of things that we kind of learned how to deal with that will prepare us for life after. And we also are going back with, like, I'm taking a lot back from Jewish America back to Israel, which I think is important because it's not just bringing Israel here, it's also bringing Jewish America to Israel, which is something I, like, didn't really think about when I first got here, and now I feel very strongly about. So that's something new. And I just feel like it's been an incredible opportunity. I could have never come up with anything even remotely as crazy as what this year has been in the best possible way. And and Tamir is fine, you know?
I want to thank you both for everything you've contributed, also to Two Jewish and to our listening audience.
And you're going
to
make us cry.
Oh, okay. Well, you know.
When you're in Israel, you're going to come and interview us.
Next year in Jerusalem.
Next year in Jerusalem. Or wherever you guys happen to be, because who knows? It might be Tel Aviv. It might be a base somewhere.
Yeah, probably a base, yeah.
And we met in Modin about a year ago now. So it's...
That's crazy.
It's crazy to think it's been a year. It's been a crazy year in so many ways.
Remember that?
And thank you for all that you've contributed. Listen, in the Siyah Tova, a great trip back and great success in the military and going forward.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor. Your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rivka has a heart attack and is rushed to the hospital. On the operating table, she has a near-death experience. She sees God and asks, "Is this the end?" God tells her, "No, Rivka, you'll have another 40 years to live." Miraculously, she recovers fully. As soon as she's recovered, Rivka figures that since she's got another 40 years, she might as well stay in the hospital. She has a facelift, the liposuction, breast augmentation, tummy and bottom tuck she always promised herself. She even changes the color of her hair to blonde. Her teeth are fixed. She looks fabulous. But just as Rivka is healed and looking wonderful, she leaves the hospital. She's crossing the driveway in front of the hospital, and she's run over and killed by an onrushing ambulance. Rivka arrives in front of God. She is furiously indignant. "God, you told me I had another 40 years to live. What happened?" God squints at her and replies, "Oi, is that you? Rivka, I didn't recognize you." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and be recognized. We will celebrate the beginning of the new month of Elul next Sunday, the final month of the Jewish year. It's a time to think about the state of our relationships, to prepare to do a cheshbon ha-nefesh, an accounting of the state of our souls, to reflect on where we are in our lives, where we've been, and where we're headed. The opening lines of this week's Parsha Re'eh are famously about choice. In a passage, Moses says to us, the people, "Re'eh, anochi noten lifnechem hayom bracha uklala, et habracha asher tishmu el mitzvot Adonai Elohechem asher anochi mitzaveh etchem hayom, haklala im lo tishmu'un el mitzvot Adonai Elohechem. See, I give you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing, if you listen to the mitzvot of your God that I command you today, and the curse, if you don't obey or listen." On the surface, this seems like a simple reinstatement of the central message repeated all through Deuteronomy. If you do good, you will be blessed. If you do evil, you'll be cursed. This Deuteronomic covenant lies at the heart of the Torah's understanding of ethics. But commentator Nachama Leibovitz points out that these are not really two parallel ifs here. Blessing if you listen, curse if you don't. Most translations hide that fact. But the Torah actually uses two different words. It says, Et habracha asher tishmu, v'ha klala im lo tishmu. That is, the blessing will be because you listen, the curse if you do not. The great commentator Rashi says, the curse is in the conditional, the blessing in the declarative. That is, the blessing of God is definite. The curse, just a possibility. Leibovitz adds that God actually gives us a kind of line of credit, a mitzvah equity loan, if you will. We can borrow blessings on the speculation that we will later likely do mitzvot. It's a good deal for us, if not necessarily for God. That can be a comforting thought. We get blessings on the likelihood that we will do mitzvot. God rewards us and then hopes, prays, that we act well. As we approach this season of tshuva, the time of return, our portion of Re'eh gives us added hope that God will always give us the benefit of the doubt, is in fact extending us credit in advance to help us with our return to being our best selves. All we have to do is take advantage of the opportunity. May it be our choice to embrace holiness and goodness in the coming month of Elul and in the days of return that follow. When we return on To Jewish, our guests, Amy and John Pregelman, will explain how they realized Holocaust survivors were often in desperate need of assistance, both financial and medical, and how they rose to the challenge and how you can help too. Find out in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A very positive story to begin. Israel, through the IDF, the military, has assisted in evacuating 422 Syrians, including many members of the White Helmets Rescue Group, to neighboring Jordan, an international humanitarian operation coordinated by the United Nations. Western powers became concerned that the volunteers' lives were at risk as Russian-backed Syrian forces tightened their grip, one of the last rebel-held areas of southern Syria. Assad regime forces intensified their offensive in the war zone recently, making the rescue effort even more urgent. The 422 Syrians were transferred to Jordan through Israel at the request of the U.S. and European countries. Israel described the move as an exceptional humanitarian gesture, adding that it continues to maintain a non-intervention policy regarding the Syrian conflict. Wise choice. The transferred Syrians will remain in a restricted area in Jordan for the time being. Jordanian Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesman Mohammed Al-Hayed said, before being transferred to England, Germany, and Canada over the next few months. A number of the over 400 people who were evacuated were from the White Helmets Volunteer Rescue Group, known as the Syrian Civil Defense. Siraj Mahmoud, a spokesman for the White Helmets in northern Syria, said, a number of civil defense volunteers, White Helmets, have been evacuated with their family members for humanitarian reasons. They were besieged in a very dangerous area. They have reached Jordan, thank God. He did not mention that they sojourned first in Israel. The White Helmets are seen as having played an important role in saving lives and showing the international community the horrors of the Syrian civil war. White Helmet volunteers have gone into war-stricken areas searching for and aiding survivors. Some have died doing that. They have won support from many countries, including the United States. A documentary about them was nominated for an Oscar last year. The civilians' passage out of Syria was organized by the UN. The UN Disengagement Observer Force administers a buffer zone between Israel's Golan Heights and Syria. It's also in charge of a border crossing near Quneitra, one of the last areas in southern Syria that remain under rebel control. These Syrian citizens who were working in the civil defense had fled the areas controlled by the Syrian opposition after the Syrian army's attack. They were evacuated because of risk to their lives, the UN reported. United Kingdom and Canada were quick to celebrate the evacuation, with British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt calling it fantastic news. He described the White Helmets as the bravest of the brave, adding that in a desperate situation, this is at least one ray of hope. Canada's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Chrystia Freeland, praised the evacuation too. The White Helmets have witnessed vicious atrocities committed by the Assad regime and its backers, she said. Jordanian Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesman Mohammed Al-Hayed said that while Jordan already hosts 1.3 million Syrian refugees, it won't hesitate to perform humanitarian duty despite the great burdens placed on the Jordanian kingdom. Distressingly, both Syria and Russia consider the White Helmets to be a terrorist organization, although they are, of course, unarmed. This is a designation the international community rejects vociferously. Syria's evil state-run news agency Sana reported Israel smuggled the White Helmets to Jordan and falsely said the volunteer group has links to terrorist groups, including the Al-Qaeda-linked Nusra Front. In less sanguine news, an arson balloon launched from Gaza landed all the way in Beersheba, the major southern Israeli city, last week. This is the farthest an arson balloon has traveled since Palestinians in Gaza began sending them up in recent months. This balloon cluster carrying an incendiary device landed on a street in Beersheba. The road was closed to cars and pedestrians. Police sappers defused the device. Beersheba is in the Negev Desert, but 25 miles from the Gaza border. At least six other fires caused by arson balloons erupted in Israeli communities bordering Gaza on a single day last week. Thousands of acres of woodlands and agricultural fields have been destroyed by incendiary devices floated over the border by Gaza Palestinians. And in Great Britain, the Labour Party has a Jewish problem, or to be more specific, a problem with a wave of anti-Semitism within its ranks and the ranks of its elected officials and party activists. This past week, a British lawmaker was suspended for sharing a post on Facebook that said it is a Jewish ritual to drink blood. He admitted publishing the article after initially denying it. 2 weeks ago, Damien Endicott, a councillor in Bognor Regis, a town on England's southern coast, told the Jewish Chronicle he didn't publish the post. He said he lives in a shared house, has a computer that doesn't have passwords. He suggested somebody else made the post in his name. But last week, Endicott, a Labour Party guy, in a new post acknowledged that these posts were his. I accept that I posted all the articles in question, that I was confused as what the papers were asking me about on the phone as I was in the middle of shopping. Shopping. That could, of course, lead you to forget you'd posted vile anti-Semitic Facebook comments. Endicott said his post headline, Jewish Ritual, They Drink Blood and Suck Babies, You Can Imagine, referred to a rite practiced by the Haredi Orthodox during a bris. This idiot was no doubt unaware that the practice is called Metzitza and is condemned by all other non-ultra-Orthodox Jews. Endicott also said he published a post saying Hitler would have the solution to the Israeli problem due to frustration at seeing unarmed civilians being shot by Israeli soldiers. I am anti-Zionist, not anti-Semitic, he wrote. Apparently he's both. Endicott said he believes the Labour Party will do the right thing and reinstate him. He adds that he would refuse to attend any courses if required to do so. He also said if he's expelled from the Labour Party, he will remain in his position as an independent. And finally he wrote, I will continue to express myself freely for my electorates. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish Amy Israel Pregelman and John Pregelman, the founders of Kavod, which serves to provide emergency aid to Holocaust survivors who are in some often desperate financial need of it. Kavod means honor or dignity in Hebrew. The organization was founded in 2015, and the work they do is, I think, remarkable. Tell us how you find out about people and how you reach out to them.
Sure. So we partner with Jewish Family Services, or really any agency that's on the ground with the survivors that are working with them. They know their situations. They know what their needs are. So we work directly through them. And right now we are working in 29 cities across the United States. And we have served over 800 survivors. I believe more than that. The numbers I haven't calculated since June. I know our numbers were high this summer, too. So that's basically how we do it.
There, you know, everybody, I think, believes that, oh, all survivors are taken care of. Now, of course, some survivors have done very well, their children have done very well, but that certainly is not true of everyone. Tell us, you know, a couple of stories, individual stories.
Sure. Well, actually, I received this email today. We have a survivor up in the Northeast. I'm not going to give us, because everything's confidential, so I'm going to try to be as general as possible.
Sure.
And we got the request from the
It's just us talking. Nobody's listening out there. It's okay.
Nobody's listening, right. typically, the requests come in exactly as John said. Some kind of emergency happens, whether it's something in their home breaks down, their car, a medical emergency, things like that. So this particular survivor has gone through a new medical emergency. I can't remember exactly. It was cancer or something that landed her in the hospital. She has all these new meds that she has to be on and a special diet. So her budget, of course, was busted from all of it. And so what we did is we ended up giving a card to a pharmacy for her medicine. And then we also gave her a gift card for groceries to help with her special diet. And I'm bringing this one up in particular because we just received a note from the agency quoting this particular person, saying that she was moved to tears and explained that this was a life-saving donation because she was feeling like she just could not breathe under the pressure of the costs that were associated with this treatment. And that's a wonderful example of how even a small amount, I think we did $650 for medicine and about $400 for groceries. People think that that's not a lot, but it makes a huge difference for these people.
As I understand it, 100% of the donations to Kavod are dispersed directly to survivors. Is that correct? So there's no overhead. You guys don't take any salaries. There's no expense. You cover all the expenses yourselves. It just goes directly to those in need.
Correct.
Yeah, that was one of our principles when we started this, was that we wanted it to be transparent so that every dollar donated, 100% would go to the survivors. And our other mission is that we will, as long as they are a survivor and have a need that comes to us through an agency, we will not turn them down. They don't need to provide financial information. They don't need to prove anything. All we need to know is that they're a survivor and that they're in trouble.
Right. And the reason behind that, of course, is the agency is already doing that work. We don't need them to double that up. And when we decided on the centerpiece of this organization, and that's why we chose the name Kavod, we wanted to take care of these people in the most dignified way. That's why we did gift cards. That's why we don't make them jump through a lot of hoops. And we're able to turn requests around in about 5 to 7 days. We get a request in from an agency. I send the request to the board. We have a board of 7 people. 5 of them are second gens.
By second gens, of course, you mean second generation survivors, the children of survivors.
That is correct. Thank you. Yes. And then I go online and purchase a gift card and send it to the agency. So it's a pretty simple, streamlined process, which is part of the whole name Kavod, meaning dignity, honor, and respect. Because ultimately, we want to do whatever we can with the little time we have left to take care of them.
Now, we know, of course, that nothing slows the clock. You know, it's, as I noted earlier, it's 70 years since the end of the Holocaust, more than that, 70, 73 years now. And this generation of survivors can't live forever. But people are living much longer than we expected, aren't they?
They are. They're living longer, and their issues are more acute because they are survivors and they had incredible trauma. So, yeah, that is true. And yet the numbers, the percentages of survivors living in this situation is still high. And it's not going to go down because the issues go up as they age.
John, I have a question for you. You embarked on this project as a—I don't want to say an amateur photographer. Your photography is incredible, but it was obviously not your first career. Tell us why you chose to photograph Holocaust survivors, which began you on this road to creating Kavod in the first place.
Well, I actually
was a professional photographer in New York when I was in my 20s.
Oh, there we go. So it was your first career. I take it back.
It was my first career. I had been doing it all through high school, and my specialty really was portraits. So when my friend called me from the Illinois Holocaust Museum to take photos, I thought it would just be a simple thing, go in, take a few, and come out. And so when I met these survivors, 80 in 3 days, and I sat in the museum with them and talked with them and heard their stories, it really seemed like the perfect match between what my training was in photography and the need of these people, because it gives them a real boost to know that the next generation is going to remember them. And we always tell them that these photos are to ensure your legacy and so that you will not be forgotten. And it also gives a face to the survivors. And we've now done 679 photos. When we just came back from Poland, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, and Charlotte. And we never charge for the photos or for our travel. Everything associated with Kavod is cost-free to the agency and to the survivors. And we give them prints of their photos as well as the electronic copies for them to have. So it really sort of engulfed me when I did those first pictures, and my friend from the museum encouraged me to continue doing that, and luckily we're able to do so.
And I have to add something to this. To watch John with these incredible humans is really a sight to be seen. He sits with them, they talk. Sometimes they talk about their story, sometimes they don't. But there is such a beautiful connection between them and John, even if it's a 15, 20-minute connection. And it's very meaningful to them. And also, John writes a handwritten note to each one. So it's a connection that extends beyond the time that's together. It's definitely soul work for him.
Sounds like it is for you, too. Is that a fair assessment, Amy?
I would say that it has developed. My background's in nonprofit, and I can tell you that, without question, this has developed into that for both of us to be able to do it together. And as John said, we just got back from Krakow on an experience that is still mind-blowing, and I know that's how we met you.
Yeah, in the interest of full disclosure, we share that's where we met, and it was totally amazing, and people have been hearing about it. If they're not tired of hearing about it on Too Jewish, they may get there by the time we're done, because it really was fantastic.
Right. And I think, we were already passionate about the project. We were already passionate about meeting these individuals and coming back from Poland and then doing this three-city tour we just did. I realized that it is so much deeper than that for us. We feel a huge responsibility to share their stories, to meet them, to take care of them, to be a witness for them. And it's our responsibility. It's what we're here to do as Jews.
What's the most surprising story from the work that you've done so far?
Oh, wow.
You mean from one of the survivor stories?
Yes, yes, if that's sure.
Well, I'll just use one that we just, there's two maybe. We were just in Charlotte and we met, as you were talking about aging, even though we estimate that there are only 10 years left, the survivors are living a long time. We just met a lady in Charlotte who's 103 and was a very famous opera singer in Holland during the war. She sang for the king and queen. She performed Snow White for Disney. And then the next day she was arrested by the Nazis because they found out she was Jewish. But she did survive.
She was extraordinary. Gorgeous.
I wish I could show you her picture because she looks about 80. And then it's like Mr. Cooperman, who just turned 105. He's in Chicago.
Wow.
He lived in a grain cellar underground for 18 months during the war with his family. Did not come out or see the sun for 18 months. And survived only on what this farmer could bring them. We could tell you so many amazing stories. I have to tell you the one about Joe Engel from Charleston. They just made a movie about him, which was, I think it's called Escape from Auschwitz. As a boy, he was on the train to Auschwitz, and it stopped outside the gate at night. And the people in the car helped him climb up over the roof of the rail car, and he jumped off into the snow, hid in the snow for 2 days, and then survived in the countryside of Poland until he was liberated.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, every story we hear, we look at each other sometimes and we're like, how is it possible that each story could be even more compelling? I have one more we met in Indianapolis, and he was a really lovely man, probably in his, I think he was in his 90s. And he started talking and he said, yeah, he ended up in Auschwitz with his mother, his father, and his brother. His mother immediately was sent to the gas chambers, ended up writing a note, being able to write a note to her husband, his father. They got to them. They have the note, and I think it's in the museum now.
Oh, my God.
And they were in the camp, survived a little bit, and then in another selection process, him and his brother were put in the line to go to the gas chambers. And in a split second, this man that he knew, who was German, who wasn't even Jewish, pulled him out of the line. He was like 14 or 15 at the time, and he put him in the other line, and he survived, and his brother didn't. And so, you know, the story, what's so incredible is when we do these meetings, when we go to communities to take photos and parlor meetings, we do a slideshow of about 20 photos, and John goes into these wonderful stories about these beautiful people, courageous people, and it's just, it's quite an experience, because he really remembers all these details. He's really good at that.
I want to thank John Pregelman and Amy Israel Pregelman for a wonderful visit here on Two Jewish. The organization is called Kavod, K-A-V-O-D, Help to Ensure Dignity for Holocaust Survivors. And your website is kavodensuringdignity.com. People can go there. They can make a donation, find out more about your work. Thank you both so much, not only for being here, but for the great work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Well, thank
so
you,
much.
Sam. We appreciate the invitation.
And it's an honor. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest will be Robert Desmond, the inspiration for The Ride for the Living, talking about his epic 1,350-mile bicycle journey from England to Poland, reenacting the Kinder transport. And, of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TwoJewishRadio.com website, Top 10 in America. Our playout this morning comes from a summary song by Enosh called Bayit al HaChof, House on the Beach. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
אני בא קרוב אלייך ברגליות, את יודעת איך הזמן איתך עושה לי טוב. אני בא קרוב אלייך ברגליות, את איתי וזה מספיק לי.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.